good, you know, I said, no, realization of the eight. The same
Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. We have a lengthy agenda today. We are going to be discussing all-terrain vehicles and off-highway vehicles today. So we have a fairly large audience, larger than normal, and would like to welcome the students that are here to join the conversation, and as well as all of the other members of the public. I do want to remind people that we need to have absolute silence in the audience so that the members of the committee can hear the testimony and that everyone can hear the discussion from the members. If you make sure to turn off your cell phones completely, we would appreciate that. Once in a while, a cell phone goes off, and sometimes that happens, but what is kind of irritating is that people let them ring, and they decide that they're going to let them ring and walk out of the hearing room as the cell phone keeps ringing. Please don't do that. If you absolutely have to take a cell phone, if you're waiting for a call, then please wait in the hall. We'd really appreciate it. We're going to begin our hearing with a presentation on the kind of background of the ATV issue from Forrest Bow with the DNR. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Forrest Bow, Division of Trails and Waterways. I'm the director. What I've prepared this morning is a chronology of events, basically starting from 1984 up through current period, that looks at certainly not everything that's happened with regard to off-highway vehicles, but kind of hits some of the highlights. And what I'll do this morning is just walk through those very quickly, try to give you an overview of what's happened in the past with regard to off-highway vehicles. Not to be all-inclusive, and certainly don't want to leave anything out, but what I think are the high points that you folks might be interested in. Hopefully you've got the handout in front of you now. If you turn to the third page, I just want to start out with some definitions, because as I go through the chronology, it would be good for everyone to have the same understanding of the various definitions. So on the third page, we have some definitions at the bottom. We talk about ATVs, Class 1 and Class 2. I'll refer to ATVs pretty generically until we get to the notes under 2006. We also have off OHM, which is off-highway motorcycles, ORVs, which is off-road vehicles. Those are the Jeeps, the 4x4s. And then the term OHV, which is really a generic term for all three, the motorcycles, the ATVs, and the off-road vehicles. So if I talk about OHV, it's everything. Otherwise, it's specific to ATV, OHM, or ORV. So I'll start from the top. Really, back in the late 1970s, we have the advent of the three-wheel all-terrain vehicle. In 1984, the legislature requires agricultural and recreational registrations and establishes an ATV funding account. In 1985, the ATV grant and aid program begins. Through the period of 93 through 95, the legislature extends registrations requirements for the off-highway motorcycles and the off-road vehicles, and those dedicated accounts are then created. During that same time period, the legislature also restricts development of motorsports parks and requests DNR to do an off-highway management study. In 1995, the study is completed, and it calls for four things. One is a coordinator position. Two, it calls for regional off-highway vehicle system plans. It calls for forest classification. Calls for state forest rule revisions. 1996, there's an interdisciplinary off-highway vehicle coordinating committee established within the DNR, and we also have USFS participation. That particular committee still exists today in a different form, but again, we've continued that effort. Also in 1996, state forest rule revisions begin, and the legislature authorizes the Iron Range off-highway vehicle recreation area at Gilbert. 1997 through 98, system planning that is called for back in 1995 begins, and we hold regional public workshops. Off-highway vehicle registration, safety, and general operating rules are adopted by the DNR. Also during that period, administrative hearings are held on the proposed forest rules, including certain hunting and trapping exemptions and a blanket ban on off-trail, off-highway vehicle travel on all state forest lands. Also during that period, DNR adopts the interim state forest classifications and solicits the public comment. Skip down to 1999. Where the legislature amends the state forest rules, permit off-trail ATV travel. In the year 2000, the legislature reinstates off-trail OHV travel ban in the limited forests, and so the final state forest classifications are adopted and forest rule revisions are adopted.
Mr. Bowe, will this be a good time to explain the definition of the classifications?
Sure. The classifications are in rule 6100.1950. Basically says that there's three classifications. There's closed, limited, and managed. Closed is just that. Those forests identified as closed are closed to off-highway vehicle traffic. Later on, you'll see that the legislature gives the commissioner authority to have off-highway vehicles on the roads in closed forests if they are designated as such. The limited classification means trails are open if posted open to off-highway vehicle use, or in other words, a trail has to be posted open in order to drive on that particular trail. A managed classification means trails are open unless posted closed.
Thank you.
In 2001, the Southwestern Minnesota Off-Highway Vehicle System Plan is approved. Now, again, we're referring back to the system plans that are called for during the 3 through 95 period. I'll skip on to 2002. In 2002, the Southeastern Minnesota System Plan is approved. The legislature extends the off-trail travel ban to managed forests with a hunting exemption. In 2002, the legislature establishes a motorized trail task force. It calls for 90 miles of trails, ATV trail on DNR Concon lands, and requests a legislative audit of the motorized trail assistance or grant and aid programs. 2003, the legislative audit report calls for added off-highway vehicle trail maintenance and enforcement, EAWs on all motorized trail projects, a reevaluation of the unrefunded gas tax formula for motorized trail programs, and improved oversight of snowmobile and off-highway vehicle grant and aid programs. Also in 2003, legislature creates the OHV damage account, provides off-highway vehicle enforcement grants to local units of government, and restricts off-highway vehicle operation in Type 3, 4, 5, and 8 wetlands and unfrozen public waters. It also directs development of a 70-mile ATV and off-highway motorcycle trail. Also in 2003, the legislature eliminates the managed forest classification and orders a road and trail inventory and a forest-by-forest review of state forest classifications. Local road authorities are authorized to restrict off-highway vehicle use in public road right-of-way and ditches, and the DNR is directed to prepare an off-highway vehicle trail study. And also, the Environmental Quality Board is directed to promulgate environmental rules relating to recreational trails. The following year, wetland riding restrictions are modified to coincide more with the Wetland Conservation Act provisions. Also in 2004, trail designation legislatively exempted from rulemaking requirements, and State Forest Road and Trail Access Inventory is completed. And that's where we inventoried over 11,000 miles of routes that are used in state forests. 2005, the Off-Highway Vehicle Trail Study is presented to the legislature. The environmental rules are finalized and adopted by the Environmental Quality Board for recreational trails. Also, in response to the legislative auditor's report, the DNR adopted an improved seven-step grant and aid project review and approval process. Also in 2005, the legislature modifies the Minnesota Rules 6100.1950 with regard to the hunting and trapping exemptions. It authorizes the DNR commissioner to restrict off-highway vehicle use for hunting and trapping in defined areas. The legislature also restores the managed classification north of Highway 2 and authorizes the commissioner to permit ATV use of forest roads in closed forests and to classify a closed portion of a managed or limited forest north of Highway 2. In 2005, the legislature creates the ORV safety program. There's some off-highway motorcycle noise emissions that were reduced. The ATV training requirement was expanded to all persons born after 1987, and the OHV damage account was extended through mid-2008. The legislature also provided enforcement officers with civil citation authority and establishes a restitution requirement for off-highway vehicle wetland violations. In 2006, the ATV gas tax study and the North Shore State Trail ATV feasibility study was presented to the legislature. Also in 2006, two classes of ATVs were enacted. A Class 2 ATV is really where you sit more side by side on the ATV as opposed to a normal ATV where you front and back. So those are the larger ATVs, greater than 900 pounds and less than 1,500 pounds. Also in 2006, we've completed 17 of our 58 forests have been reclassified. And finally, in 2007, we're anticipating an additional 20 forests to be reclassified by the end of 2007. We also want to make note that the planning process for all 58 forests are on track. We do intend to complete all of those by December 31st of 2008, as directed by the legislature. One last item is the Trail Planning Design and Development Guidelines, or Best Management Practices Manual. I didn't mention it, but way back in 2000 or 2001, we started that endeavor, and now we actually have it ready and is being published at this time. It will be available later this month. We'll make sure legislature gets several copies of that. Feel free to contact us if you need one directly.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Ball? Mr. Ball, can you talk about the classification, the inventory process to date? DNR has been assessing the trails and designating trails in the various state forests. How many forests are there that we need to do that in? How many are done so far? When do you think it'll be done? How many of them are closed, limited, or managed so far? What do you anticipate the remaining forests to be classified as?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have assessed all of the trail mileages in our state forest. That's basically in 2005, we have come up with 11,000 miles of trail on state forest lands. Currently going through the process of forest reclassification, determining whether a forest is closed, limited, or managed, and also making determinations as to which trails remain open. We go through a environmental procedure or environmental review. It is an abbreviated one. It's done by department employees, a team of interdisciplinary department employees, to determine that all the routes that are that do remain open are sustainable. We are in the process of designating trails and reclassifying all of our 58 state forests. We currently have 17 completed, and by the end of 2007, we anticipate that there would be an additional 20 forests completed. So by that time, we'd have 37 of the 58. The legislature has given us a deadline of December 31st of 2008 to complete the assignment, and we are on track to get all of those forests reclassified and roads and trails designated in those forests. Of the 17 forests that have gone through the process to date, got a chart here that of the 17 forests that have been completed to date, we have 5 forests that have been closed. Sorry, 6 forests that have been closed, and the rest are all limited classification.
I apologize, I didn't get that last to
Mr. Chair, to date, of the 17 forests that have been completed, 17 total. 6 of those are closed, and the remaining are limited classification. Okay.
And what are we looking at? And those are all south of Highway 2?
That's correct. We have not completed a forest north of Highway 2 at this time.
Do you have... can you anticipate what forests... north of Highway 2 will be classified as?
Mr. Chair, we have gone through a great deal of planning on the Beltrami Island State Forest. It appears the team's recommendation for that forest will be managed classification. I think there's another forest, I think it's the Cloquet Valley, that is currently going out for some public comment. I think that one will be recommended as a managed classification as well. And I'm sure there are others.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bull, what criteria might close a forest, just for my information?
Mr. Bull.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin. Typically, what would close a forest is we take into account a variety of factors. One is current use of the forest. Has it traditionally been closed, or has it traditionally been for non-motorized uses? That would certainly weigh in heavily on whether that particular forest is closed. Also, some of the adjacent lands, for instance, if a forest is up in the boundary waters, it would make sense that that particular forest would be a closed forest.
Further questions for Mr. Bull? Members, I think this background chronology is very helpful. I think it for someone who wasn't up to speed on ATV issues, it really helped me kind of get kind of bring everything in context and just kind of see where we're at from a bird's eye point of view. And I think when we're approaching some of these bills, I think it's I think this back chronology is an important important piece of the puzzle, so I certainly encourage people to study it. Any other questions for Mr. Bow? I'm sure you'll be sticking around during the presentation of these bills. Okay, thank you so much. We'll take 1538 next. The process, members, will be the same as what we've been using for all the other bills. If the bill has money in it, we will. If the committee agrees, we will pass it on to finance, and if it does not have money in the bill, if it's just policy, then we will lay it over for consideration in the omnibus bill. If there's enough language, then I would anticipate a separate ATV article. And then if it has to do with other committees like transportation and the gas tax issue, then we'll forward it on to those committees as well. If there aren't any other questions, we'll move on to Senate File 1538.
Senator Shadrach, Senate File 1538.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just give you kind of the backdrop of genesis of this bill. Before I became chair of this committee, I did not have a very in-depth knowledge of the ATV issue. Obviously, I was a member of the committee, but I think others were kind of taking on the issue before me. But when I became chair, I think it was critical that I become more versed in all the nuances that the ATV issue presents itself with. So for about the past 3 months, I've been on this proverbial journey to understand the ATV issue from all points of view. I've literally gone to the four corners of the state, some walking, some riding, to try and understand all of the issues that surround ATVs. Spent a lot of time, dozens of hours, visiting with stakeholders in this process, environmental groups, ATV clubs, industry, departments, county officials, state officials, to try and get a clear understanding of why this issue is controversial, and to kind of apply the philosophy that I laid out in the first committee hearing of this session of whether we can, by sitting down and trying to understand what people are really saying with this issue, see if we can come up with some reasonable solutions that people can support, that people can support, or at least which they can support most. And so we met, went to Grand Marais, met with people who were diametrically opposed to each other on this issue, people who felt that ATVs, and I quote, are a dirty, nasty habit, to people who were on the completely other side of that issue. They just were sick and tired of the tree huggers trying to take away good Minnesota jobs. I think I've heard it all. But amongst all of that, I noticed a majority of individuals who were interested in some of the same fundamental things. Whether they be environmentalist or ATVer, were interested in preserving our environment, interested in, equally interested in getting at some of the bad actors that were giving ATVs a bad name, that were interested in designated trails, were interested in places where you could ATV, but places where you didn't ATV, and people who are interested in more enforcement of our ATV rules, and people who are interested in promoting ATV education and ATV safety. And these people on these issues that I've listed come from both sides of the issue. Clubs, environmentalists alike, have discovered we're interested in all of these issues in the same way. Maybe nuances and approaches differed, but fundamentally, I discovered that there are a lot more things in common on this issue than there were uncommon. Now, I'm presenting my bill, and I could be completely wrong, and after I present my bill, environmentalists and the clubs come up here and come to fisticuffs over whatever I'm proposing. But I think that we have a reasonable approach in this bill that approaches, that seeks to resolve 75% of the what I believe to be outstanding issues regarding ATVs in our state. And I think that's a good chunk. That's a good chunk of, and it's a very good start. But most importantly, I really found that when nerves were calmed and ears were opened and understanding was sought, there was really a lot that we could fundamentally agree on in this issue. So this bill encompasses a lot of those concepts. The big sore point from 2005 was the issue of the managed classification north of Highway 2. A lot of people felt the issue had been resolved. A lot of people didn't. So I tried to figure out a way, first of all, figure out what the big objection was to managed classification and why we needed to have an exception north of Highway 2. And so I took a trip north of Highway 2, we drove around the trails. It was way too cold for an ATV, but we went out with a map and looked at all the different types of land that trails go on. You've got your, not only do you have your state land, you've got your county land, you've got federal land, you've got tribal land, you've got ConCon land, we've got LUP land, and all of these types of land, and we've got private land. All of these types of land are in a literal checkerboard placement across much of the northern part of our state. So the point of view from the clubs and the ATVers standpoint is that, well, we've got all these different types of land uses. We can't physically, or it would be very difficult physically, to post every trail open
and then leave the rest closed unless they were posted open. So that from their point of view, it's very difficult to do that, given that checkerboard of land uses. From the environmentalist point of view, that open unless posted closed designation presents some environmental issues. The primary one being that if it's not posted, if it's open unless it's posted closed, then that leaves the opportunity for someone to drive off trail illegally. But the second person coming by seeing that trail that was created by a ATV is suddenly legal because it's a trail. It doesn't have to be posted. It's not posted closed. So I'm legal to drive on it, whether it's a wetland or on a wetland or it's on a... on a sensitive rise, or it's a muddy rise, or wherever it is, that new trail that's never been inventoried or designated by the DNR is suddenly legal. And so that's problematic, too. So how can we, and I think there are probably other objections with the managed classification, but I think that's the primary one that I've heard. And so I set out to try and find out what we can do about that loophole without having to, affecting the complexities of this checkerboard land use. In the discussions, the discussion always came back to, not from me, but from whether it be clubs or environmentalists, always came back to what is being mapped by the DNR in terms of a trail. The discussion always seemed to turn back to the map. What trails are on the map? So, for right or wrong, the light bulb went off in my head, saying, "Okay, well, why don't we try and require that all riding simply be on the map? Since we know that whether it's a managed classification or not, the trails are going to be on a map." And so we could solve this loophole of people making their own trails, which no one was interested in supporting, by simply requiring that all ATV riding be on a map. This would not interfere with the DNR process. They would do their inventory. They would designate their trails. And whenever they designate their trails, they would create a map. At the moment, it's a paper map. We could even make it an online map that can be updated nimbly, or even downloaded to a GPS or a handheld phone. But it always seemed to center on the map. So what we're proposing on page 2, subdivision 3, map trails, it's a simple three-line change or addition that says a person must not operate their vehicle on state land that's not mapped for the type of off-highway vehicle. And I've been kind of bouncing this idea off various stakeholders for about a month now. And have been racking my brain as to a real critical eye towards myself, how three lines could make such a big difference. And what would the objections and the unintended consequences be? And at the moment, I haven't heard anything, but that's something I really want this committee to examine is whether this can work. I think it does. I think it does. From what I heard from the clubs, what I've heard from environmental groups, this is something that could potentially work. And so that's the three lines in there, and that's it's an important change, but it's a simple one. And I think most folks, including myself, are kind of chewing on it and scratching our heads how such a simple change could make such a big difference. But I think it does, and but I would appreciate the committee's discussion on that. The next issue of critical discussion in all the listening sessions I did was the issue of enforcement. And I'm skipping around the bill just kind of in order of importance, not the sequence of the bill. But the next issue was the order, was the enforcement, how we're going to get more people out to enforcing our rules. There seemed to be just as much interest in having quality enforcement on the part of the clubs as there was on environmental groups. And so how do we increase that enforcement, and where do we find the money to do that? So we've in this bill, you know, there's been gas tax proposals, and we'll hear that. That's the governor's proposal, and others support that. Others find that problematic. Senator Saxhog had a proposal about a trail sticker, like we do with the snowmobiles, and that has merit as well. And then this proposal looks to the ATV registration fee. The $30 that you pay every 3 years to register your ATV, and that $30 is currently below what we pay what a snowmobiler would pay. Snowmobiles pay $45, and that money goes into the snowmobile account and goes towards trails and enforcement. And so I'm proposing to raise the ATV registration fee by $15 every 3 years. That raises about $1.5 million, maybe even a little bit more, $1.6 million. Almost $1.6 million a year in fees that can be attributed to whatever we want to designate in the account.
Question, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, you said you're going to raise it $15 every 3 years, or is it it's $15 that is paid? You're raising it $15 in the bill that will be paid every 3 years.
Correct.
But you're not automatically escalating it $15 every 3 years.
Maybe I should clarify. It's a fee that is paid every 3 years, the $30 every 3 years, and I'm proposing to increase that by $15. So you pay $45 every 3 years instead of $30 every 3 years.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, that brings it up equal with the snowmobiles you were saying. Is that correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
We passed out a spreadsheet of current expenditures of the all-terrain vehicle account, how we arrive at the $1.6 million, and what I'm proposing to use with the new money. And I'm proposing to increase enforcement by $500,000. The next issue is critical issue in the ATV issue is where people can ride and trails, having trails on the ground. And I'm using part of that ATV registration fee increase to double the amount of money to grant and aid trails. So it would go from $575,000 to $1,075,000. And then the next issue with the ATVs has been the education and safety. And I'm proposing to use an increase of $500,000 towards education and safety. Excuse me, education and training. Part of the education and training increase that I'm proposing includes a proposal for volunteers to be on the ground doing their own monitoring of the trails as well. This has been called the Ambassador Program. Wisconsin uses an ambassador program that funds, I believe it funds clubs, and I'm not sure if it allows others into that program as well. I'm getting a nod from Mr. Knopf that it does. So clubs and environmental groups are allowed to, they are paid to have people go in, go trails and, you know, ride up and down, whether it be on an ATV or a bicycle, or to monitor trails, can just kind of be friendly stewards of the trail system. And if there's a violator, if they see someone violating, they call it into the local DNR office. We're going to talk about this a little bit more, but the some environmental groups are opposed to the ambassador program because it gives money to the clubs, and I'm just kind of paraphrasing what they are saying in some of their written documents, and so what I've proposed a little change in this to model it after Wisconsin to create an ambassador program that puts money in not only to the clubs but allows other organizations to participate in the ambassador program. Clubs don't like other groups involved with the ambassador program. Primarily, they're afraid that this is going to be an avenue or open a door for more radical interests to take advantage of this ambassador program and kind of go in and create problems and that are unnecessary. So I've addressed that by putting in the ambassador program a training certification program for those monitors and clubs, that they have to be a part of this. And I think that solves the issue. There might still be some concern about it. I think those concerns are probably center around issues of trust more than practicality, but I'm not interested in creating problems with this ambassador program. I want to create a solution. So whatever we need to do to make it work, I'm willing to discuss. That's the meat of the bill. I also actually on some discussions that Senator Saxhog has initiated. Page one, I do start off the bill with creating an ATV season. This is kind of just general language. I'm not kind of prescribing what I think the season should be. I've left it really kind of wide open. But I think in general, during wet seasons, it's probably a good idea to give the earth a rest. I've got some exceptions for winter trails and such, and I'm just kind of... There's issues regarding when the wet season occurs in the south part of the state or the north part of the state, and so those things would need to be worked out. But that's just kind of the general principle, and whatever we need to do to make that work, I'm willing to discuss.
Senator Chaudhry, could I have you go to Section 4 on page 3 and just talk a little bit about traditional areas in state forests and why you felt the need to include that?
This is the next issue. Page 4, we're creating a state traditional areas. This has been a proposal. This is a principle that has actually been espoused by both environmental groups and the clubs, that there ought to be some areas where we don't do ATVing, whether it be quiet zones or heritage areas or traditional areas, whatever you call it. The latest proposal, this language comes off of the latest proposal from it builds off of the latest proposal, what I think is the Audubon Society, to create traditional areas. Their proposal is goes farther. It wants a minimum of 50% of a state forest to be designated a traditional area. And this, my bill does not have that. Just kind of centering on the common ground here, and if the committee wants to have a percentage in there, I'm open to whatever the committee decides. But this is kind of establishing that there is going to be some areas of our forests where there's not ATV riding.
Senator Saxhog.
I think that's the
excuse me, Senator Saxhog.
It's the length short of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Chaudhry, I like a lot of your ideas here. I do have one question on the traditional areas. And obviously you and I agree that the checkerboard areas of any, particularly in the northern part of the state where we have the state and the federal and the county and private, are problematic in terms of management. And in fact, I think we've talked about forest land consolidation. In other words, the exchanging of land so that they can be better managed. So, but I do have a real question, being an old county commissioner, on this tax forfeited lands within traditional areas being managed by the commissioner. So I think we're going to run into a few problems there with usurping some county the county's powers in that particular area, and I hope that through our discussions we encourage again the forest land consolidation so that we can better manage that. But I think we are going to run into some problems if we start managing lands that are not rightfully ours to manage.
The this line is in the bill because of the issue that you raise. From what I've learned from the research I've done, the county forfeited lands are actually owned by the state of Minnesota. Is that your understanding as well?
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, they're held in trust by the state, or held in, who has them in trust?
Mr. Knopf, can you help us?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Saxhog, the Commissioner of Revenue holds the title to the properties. They're held by the Commissioner of Revenue, but they are held by the state in trust for the taxing districts, and they are managed by the county board. There are some lands within forests where the county board has given over management to the state, but not all tax forfeited lands within state forests.
So Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, you're right. Incidence of ownership is actually with the state, but we as a state have, for the most part, given up our management of those lands.
So the reason I put this in there, Senator Saxhog, is for the purposes of traditional areas. I don't touch this. I know I understand this can be a delicate issue, but for the purposes of traditional areas, we need to figure out whether we're going to have. I mean, the purpose of this traditional area is to have no ATV. So if we want to have a traditional area on a state forest, then I think we need to clarify this part. Otherwise, the state could have a traditional area in statute, but because a county manages it, they could have their, they could allow ATVs through that area. So I think if we're going to have traditional areas, at least for the purposes of traditional areas, we need this language. But if there's something else, another idea, I'm certainly open to it. I don't want to open a can of worms, but I, if we're going to have traditional areas, it would kind of defeat the purpose if we, if they're county, the county lands within those state forests have ATVs.
Well,
follow up, Senator Saxog, or did that get?
Well, I thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the point is taken, and it is something we're going to have to discuss. But I don't think it's probably the solution to this particular their problem. Okay. And and again, the solution I believe is forced land consolidation, that the state and the county exchange lands or whatever needs to be done so that the management of them can be more comprehensive.
Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Chaudhry, and in fact I would like to hear from department on this as well, in that same section of traditional area sub 3, well, actually in sub 1, you're underlined language on 330. Kind of conflicts with what you have in sub 3, number 3, under no hunting or trapping use. First of all, I noticed that in the traditional areas you do not include trapping. I wonder if that was what the purpose of that non-inclusion is. And then secondly, why you outlaw it on page 4, line 4. Excuse me, line
6.
6. ATVs have been, permitted by the state through legislative action from several years ago. It was in Mr. Bowles' summary for purposes of hunting and retrieving your animals, and trappers, I believe, could do it as well because they do haul quite a load of traps in and out, and the animals are kind of heavy when they're coming out after they've been soaked with water for a while. So why are you
Mr. Chair,
outlawing
Senator.
Trapping and hunting in one way and then in saying that you're going to have trapping in another, hunting in another, but no trapping?
Senator Chaudhry.
Chair, Senator Parasol, on 3, the definition, the omission of trapping is an error. That in. On page 4, remember, in a traditional area, we're asking that certain areas not have off-highway vehicles. So that would include hunting or trapping using off-highway vehicles. That's what that subdivision 3 is aiming at.
In a traditional area.
If correct.
I could finish your sentence, kind of.
Okay.
Correct.
I understand that's what he's saying now. But then what is the difference in using for those purposes and the ones that are included in lines 30 and 31 on page 3? What's the difference?
The difference
except
is
the trajectory in one case, but.
Mr. Chair, Senator Parasol, the difference is in the definition we are stating what traditional uses are. Logging, hunting, fishing, trapping, we can certainly amend, wildlife, hiking, biking, canoeing, berry picking. So that's what we're defining what we mean by a traditional area, the use for a traditional area. And then as opposed to the vehicle restrictions, we're clarifying that even though you can hunt and trap in those traditional areas, we don't mean that you can hunt and trap or berry pick with ATV. Now, remember, we are not, in this bill, we are not prescribing where those traditional areas should be. I'm leaving that up to the DNR. In fact, the DNR is already in the process of kind of examining areas where this type of traditional area or heritage area or quiet zone could be placed. So this is not too radical of a proposal because it's already being examined.
Senator Parasol?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering where the source of this concept came from DNR or from Senator Chaudhry?
It was not my original idea. It's an idea that's kind of morphed over from discussions from a variety of groups. The ATV clubs have discussed themselves the idea of quiet zones. Some of the environmental groups have talked about heritage zones or heritage areas. This one is a traditional, this is called a traditional area. The DNR has also been examining on their own in their trail designation process to have areas of a forest that where you don't have that type of ATV riding, where, you know, hunting and trapping is not disturbed. So this is this language I take from the I pretty much take from the proposal from the Audubon Society, but I don't have the that 50% designation in there.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Chaudhry, just a couple of questions. First of all, on the season that you propose on the first page, you talked about the wet season, and I was surprised that April was the, you consider that the end of the wet season. I would think that spring is the wettest time, and there's still snow on the ground in some parts of Minnesota, at least there used to be, in April. So I thought that seemed a little early, that you might go through May to, if you wanted to protect the time of the year when the ground is wet and muddy and subject to damage. I also want to ask about the concept of mapping trails. I think it's an interesting idea. I'm just having a hard time understanding how it would work, because, you know, you can't just look at a map on the website, on the web or on a piece of paper and go follow it through the woods unless there's some kind of a marking system. And I understand you're trying to do that as an alternative to posting signs and probably surveying and everything that goes into that. So how would you, there must be some kind of a marking system to be able to allow people to find those trails and know that they're actually on them. How would that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, on your first question, the dates I have for the seasons are proposed parameters for a season. I don't say it should be April 15th, and as I mentioned in my opening remarks, it might be later. So I'm just saying that the commissioner shall prescribe a season, and maybe that's confusing, and so I should clarify that I would like the commissioner to designate exactly what those seasons, and those seasons might be different for northern Minnesota and southern Minnesota.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry,
well, it could be May 1st, as you
said. Somewhere between April and December is what you're saying, rather
correct.
Than those are the dates. I
correct.
Didn't understand that. So
yes,
that
correct.
Probably should be clarified.
Sure.
That would be helpful.
And then on the mapping question, Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, no, I'm not proposing that we not have a marking system that we're currently working on now. But I'm adding to that, I don't know if you want to call it a clarification of the rule, that even whether it's if even though it's marked, you need to be on that mapped trail, and I think that's the crux in, and these trails are going to be mapped anyway, so if we have the rule that says you have to stay on that, the red line, then that'll prevent people from going off trail. But no, I don't propose that we stop the whatever signposting that we're doing now.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry. Going back to a section Senator Anderson referenced, the season, the off-highway vehicle season, do you intend that season to be April 15th to December 31st, or do you intend the Commissioner of Natural Resources to designate a time period between those two dates when there would be?
Mr. Chair, Senator Frederickson, the latter.
Would have
correct.
The expression.
Correct. And reading this language, I think I can understand why that's confusing. And I think that needs to be clarified, that that's what I intend.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, I share Senator Anderson's concern about April 15th being too early, particularly in the northern part.
Yeah.
Where there might be some ponding of water and some destruction. And I'd like to also discuss, I think it is, the vehicle restrictions in the restricted, in the traditional area. And I have some of the same concerns Senator Parasol had, and I was wondering if you had considered, or would you consider on the hunting restriction to allow the retrieval only of big game. If an individual possesses a valid hunting license and has taken a moose or a bear or a deer, that they could retrieve the animal with an ATV in that area. And the other suggestion I would have is to allow ATVs to be used for tending traps if the individual has a valid trapping license and is during the season, to allow a couple very closely crafted exceptions for those. It's a suggestion I have, and I was curious if you had considered that and rejected it or are open to a suggestion like that.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Fredrickson, I've considered the exceptions in relation to the mapped trail requirement. I don't touch the exceptions in my mapped trail requirements. I had not talked about or considered the exceptions with regards to traditional areas. So I don't know if I don't have an opinion way on it.
Follow-up?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, as you know, if somebody has taken a moose, for example, and they're 2 or 3 miles back in the woods, it seems a little unreasonable to not allow them to use an ATV just to retrieve the animal, or a big deer or a bear.
Senator Fredrickson, I think the one of the important questions, I think, in that scenario is, do we allow that type of retrieval now?
Yes. And Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, I've been as restrictive and tough on the inappropriate use of ATVs as I think anybody, but I think those are some reasonable things to consider.
Okay. I think you're right.
Senator Dibble, did you have a question?
I do, Senator Scoggin, but Senator Saxog has a question on a point that was previously raised. I was going to raise a new
Senator
subject.
Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Chaudhry, I was just going to comment that although I don't think it's in statute, snowmobiling has for years really gone on maps. You know, I mean, I realize there's pirate trails different places, and there always will be, but generally designated trails have been very successful in the snowmobile sport. And one other thing I was just going to mention is, along with Senator Fredrickson talking about retrieving of animals, did we think about utilities, which was in traditional areas, and the use of any motorized vehicle in a traditional area to if they need to be fixed or...
Okay, you're talking about
Electric
utilities,
right.
For example, yeah. No, if we need to clarify that's fine.
Senator Dibble.
I've asked Senate counsel to research to take copious notes on these suggestions.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Chaudhry, I was just very recently made aware of the concerns about the ambassador program, particularly with respect to, civilians, non-trained, non-public safety officer type people getting involved in some of the enforcement stuff and some of the concerns that raises. And I was wondering if you could respond to those concerns. I think that it's easy to conceive of where those problems might lie, and if you considered to achieve a better outcome to take some of those funds that are generated from the additional the increase to the fee and just simply put that into enforcement so there's more officers out on the ground or officers have more time to do this kind of enforcement. As I read through the ambassador program, some of it is great, the education and some of that stuff is great. I think the concerns around monitoring, which I think implies enforcement, do need to be thought through somewhat. So how would you respond to the idea of maybe putting more funds into enforcement, being more officers or freeing up more officers' time?
I like the ambassador program. That's why I have it on the bill, because there's a successful model for it in Wisconsin. And this has been a way not only to have closer monitoring of the trails, because COs can't be everywhere. Our clubs and other organizations are. I mean, they are constantly on the trails, doing the grooming, doing the cleanup, and these folks are in a excellent position to make sure that laws are being followed, number one. But at the same time, making sure that best practices are followed. Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's a good idea. And these folks, with the right training, certification, and monitoring of the monitors, can be excellent liaisons to the broader ATV riding community. And I think that's why I'm really, really like the ambassador program. And like I said, a conservation officer can't be everywhere. And I know that with hunting or fishing. And so if you have, particularly when you have a issue surrounding environmental sensitivity, political sensitivity, if you have citizens who are interested in making this sport better, safer, more environmentally sustainable, then I think you've got, I think you really have an opportunity for a real citizen buy-in. Maybe I have an ulterior motive. I want these people to be out there together. I want folks from the Audubon Society and ADVAM out there on the trails, you know, with their whatever orange vests, out there talking to each other as much as they are talking to riders. So that's my hope with this, and I think it can be done. And I think I've addressed some of the concerns that both sides have with the ambassador program, making sure that any group that is certified and trained is allowed to be in it, but at the same time, making sure that we've got the adequate monitoring. So that's really why I'm so interested in this. I want to add that the way I fund this, I don't propose to fund this out of enforcement. I'm proposing to fund this out of education and training. So I've got the full $500,000 for conservation officers. That whole increase goes to conservation officers, and we're up to then $2 million for enforcement. There has been an issue raised about whether that actually means conservation officers for ATV enforcement, and we can certainly make sure the language is lock solid on that. But then I make sure that this ambassador program comes out of the education and training
follow-up
of the funding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple follow-up questions. How do we know? I'm not challenging. I'm just curious. How do we know that the Wisconsin model is successful? What measures of success do we look to coming from Wisconsin? First question. Second question is, how do the conservation officers feel? Do we know, or how does DNR feel about this proposal? Are they comfortable with working with citizens in this capacity?
I think I am going to hold the answer to that question to some of the testimony. I think that some folks are going to testify as to what they think about the program. I think it's generally positive, but I'll let some of the people who have really researched this speak on it.
Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Chaudhry?
I think some folks wanted to talk on the bill.
Okay.
Many of
Welcome. State your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gene Larimar with the Jack Pine Coalition. And I wish to talk about the Ambassador Program, or the OHV Safety and Conservation Program. We can accept for today, at least, that the program has been successful. I mean, I know of no research that says it is, or no criteria for which you would judge that. We can accepting that for today, that it is successful. It could very well be it's because of other reasons that exist in the ATV environment in Wisconsin that do not exist here. Just as you can't transplant a palm tree to Ely, Minnesota, you shouldn't think that we can transplant this program to Minnesota without making some other fairly serious changes. Changes, by the way, that have been proposed in a legislature before. For one thing, and my source for this is the handy little clip put out by Wisconsin DNR. It's called Wisconsin All-Terrain Vehicle Laws. Okay? And I just went through there, and I picked out some things that we don't have in Minnesota. I think we should not do an ambassador program unless we have these kinds of things. First, in Wisconsin, 51% of their special fund goes to enforcement. Minnesota, as my rough calculation is, it's about a third of that special fund. Wisconsin, the wardens, that's what they call conservation officers, have much smaller districts than conservation officers in Minnesota. They don't have as much territory to cover. There's more enforcement in effect. In Wisconsin, ATVs are ridden only on designated trails. That is no longer the case in Minnesota. We had that compromise in 03, and it was shattered in 05. So we have the possibility, as we heard earlier, that lots of acres of state forests are going to be classified managed, which would make it, I think, not only impossible for somebody in the ambassador program to figure out, you know, who's doing what, but probably a CO as well. In Wisconsin, under most circumstances, you cannot operate an ATV on any highway or roadway. I'm not talking ditches here. I'm talking on top. Because in Minnesota, once the township passes an ordinance, you can run your ATV on township roads. It's becoming a serious safety issue. You can also ride your ATV on forest roads. In this little manual also tells us that in Wisconsin you cannot assume that an ATV can be ridden in ditches the same way snowmobiles do. Now, all of us who live up north, or those of us who go up north a lot, see how much ditch riding is occurring. And I don't know what you would expect somebody in the ambassador program to do. I mean, it seems to me this is the kind of issue that is totally inappropriate. And until we ban, you know, riding in ditches, I think the idea of an ambassador program is really weakened. In Wisconsin, and we have tried to get this kind of legislation passed in the past, and we were unsuccessful. In Wisconsin, you must slow to 10 miles an hour or less. You get within 100 feet of another person walking or on a bicycle, within 100 feet of an ice house, for people who fish on the ice in houses, and within, you have to slow down to 10 miles per hour or less if you get within 150 feet of a home or dwelling. Lots of the ditch riding goes by homes close to the ditch within that period, and I don't know how you're going to have somebody with an orange vest, even if Ray Bone and I were out there together, what we would do about that. And lastly, snowmobile snowmobile trails are not automatically open to ATV use in Wisconsin. Some circumstances they are. So there's a context here. There's a culture and a web of practices and laws and traditions that we don't have in Minnesota. Until we put some of these things in, I think the ambassador program would be a waste of money. On top of that, we already have a volunteer program within the DNR that is more or less moribund because it hasn't been funded. If we're going to do something with volunteers, I suggest that we do that through the DNR. Questions?
Questions for Mr. Merrimore. Senator Sieben.
Thank you. Actually, this question is for Senator Chaudhry, but I think the testifier may have some comments, too. So is your idea of the ambassador program, Senator, that it would only be used, the ambassadors would only maintain the trails? They wouldn't at all monitor the riding habits of people on ATVs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, it's actually the opposite. The clubs would already, through their grant and aid money, be maintaining trails. The ambassador program is, in addition to that activity, where they would be also monitoring trails. But also, not just clubs. It could be, in my legislation, I have any organization could be allowed to do that.
Follow up?
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, so then, just to clarify, they would be monitoring the trails, not the riders themselves. Is my question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, if a monitor saw a violation, they would be trained in the ability to call a conservation officer to enforce the violation.
But, Mr. Chair, but they themselves could not make any stops or try to stop the offender from doing whatever they're doing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, that's correct.
Okay.
They would not be allowed to do that.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Merriman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ray Bone. I'm here representing the All-Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota and also the Amateur Riders Motorcycle District 23. And with me is Tom Umfris. Tom, you can introduce yourself.
Yep. Thank you, committee. My name is Tom Umfris. I am here representing the Amateur Riders Motorcycle Association, also District 23 of the American Motorcycle Association, representing about 300,000 riders throughout the country, about shy of 8,000 here in the state of Minnesota. Involved in many other national organizations and state organizations as well, mainly focused on rider education, working with the land managers to make sure that everybody understands what riders are looking for, what land managers are looking for in the management of riding, and working back with the clubs and the riders on how we can be responsible individuals out there using our resources. And kind of covering both sides of the story there, making sure that everybody understands what everybody's looking for and what's responsible there.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, first of all, we would like to say thank you to Senator Chaudhry for his willingness to work with us on these issues. They're important issues. You know, we really appreciate the opportunity to sit down and talk about these issues, discuss these issues in a way we're not yelling at one another. We're actually trying to figure, working towards solutions. Because everything Senator Chaudhry said was right on in terms of we have much more in common than we have not in common, I believe. And I've seen that many times, the few times where we actually did sit down and chat about some of these issues, became readily apparent to me that there was more commonality than not. We don't propose to have any amendments today to Senator Chaudhry's bill. We hope we have the opportunity to work on this legislation and use it as a vehicle to work through some of these issues. This bill, we believe, is a good start.
towards moving forward and working with other groups in working out the details. You know, the devil obviously is always in the details. What we'd like to do is go through the bill very quickly and kind of give you our viewpoint on some of these issues.
Mr. Bowen, before
yes,
you do that, Senator Chaudhry, is anyone else going to testify on this bill? Because across the hall we have a couple of senators who want to be sure they're here for the vote. So we just want to give them a heads up about when that may be.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure who else wants to testify, but we'll make sure that there's...
Just one here? Anyone else that wants to test? Oh, we'll tell the other senators it'll be a while. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dibble.
Oh, thank you. I was just going to ask a process question of Chair Chaudhry. What is your intent, Senator Chaudhry? Is it to move these bills along or to hold on to them and do some work, as Mr. Bowen indicated? Or
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I mentioned this at the beginning of the hearing. What I intend to hold the same process as we have for the rest of the bills that we've already heard this session. If it's got money in it and the committee agrees with the bill, then we'll pass it to finance. If it needs to go to another policy committee and the committee agrees with the bill, then we'll send it to that other committee. And if it's policy only, then it'll be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Bowen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I...
Senator Dibble, so this bill has money in it, so if folks agree with this bill, then we would forward it on to finance.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, then I hope you take my comments as constructive comments, because we do have issues that I think need to be worked on more fully. And we are hoping that we get an opportunity to do that. First of all, the season issue. One of the things we rely on a great deal is for DNR to help us make those decisions on a year-by-year basis in terms of when we should be out there and when we shouldn't. And I agree that I think the commissioner should be making those decisions because, you know, some years, if it's dry, it may be perfectly fine for us to be out there on April 1st. Other years, it may not be fine for us to be out there on some trails till May 15th. So I think we really need to give the land manager as much flexibility, I think, as possible. One of the things, when I first saw this, I thought, gee, this looks, you know, like a good idea. But the more I thought about it in talking with other people, one of the issues that came up is, well, what about people that use ATVs for ice fishing? You know, those could be in a forest. The lake could be in a forest. Does that mean then you can't use your ATV to pull your ice house out or to go out and visit your ice house? I'm not an ice fisher person myself, but I do know I see it on TV where you hear about a few going through the ice occasionally, along with cars and other vehicles, but also... people use ATVs to go out to their ice house and come back in, especially some of the more local folks. So I think we need to look at some of those issues, how they're used with those applications. Trail riding is I think a kind of a different animal, but I think that's an issue that needs to be discussed a little more. So I think those two issues, the subdivision 3 dealing with the map trails. I still don't know as though we're clear what that means. And again, I wouldn't say we're opposed to that. I just think that we need more information to try to figure that one out. On the ambassador or vehicle safety and conservation program, we have actually visited Wisconsin. We've talked to Wisconsin officials, the DNR. We've also talked with the Wisconsin ATV group. And it's my understanding the DNR feels very, very strongly about the program. It has worked very effectively. We would offer to bring over Mr. Randy Harden, who is the person who started this program, and can even ask for the Wisconsin DNR to come over and talk to you about how their program works. Because from all our indications we receive, it works very well. But they are very, very strict about their training. They're very strict about the people that are allowed to do this. You have to be a certified instructor, for example, and you have to go through this training. They actually do a background check as well on all individuals before they authorize them to do this. And it is, again, a monitoring function. Both trail what's going on in the trail, but also what the if there are conditions in the trail, say there's a hole developing or something that could be dangerous to riders, they will report that as well and make sure that's taken care of. So it's a fairly encompassing, more of a monitoring program than anything. But the plan is to have them out there on the trail, talking to people, working with people, reminding people that if they don't have a registration, that geez, you know, you're supposed to be registered, but not stopping anyone, but just, you know, trying to strike up some conversations with people as they're out there. They may set up a coffee shop or some coffee at the trailhead, and when people come to get on their ATVs and go on the trail, spend some time talking with them. And again, the ambassador, act as ambassador. That's the concept that we want. We don't want confrontation out there because that leads to obviously problems. You know, we're little, I have to admit, we're very leery about letting non-OHV people get involved in this program. And the reason we're leery, and I think Senator Chaudhry said it best, is that we don't want people coming in that's going to torpedo our program. and there is a trust issue. There's no doubt about it. There is a trust issue. But I think, you know, again, this is something that we need to have hopefully some more conversation on. So I think in terms of this proposal, what we'd like to do is ensure that there's also adequate training to those individuals. We just don't, you know, actually beyond the threshold, which we think is you should be a certified instructor, number one. And when we talk about safety, what we mean is safety and environment, because when we do our training, it encompasses both safety and environmental issues. But in addition to that, there should be additional training, and we would have to figure out, Senator, what that all encompasses. But again, I think the Wisconsin model gives us a good start. In terms of the advisory council, I guess our position would be, again, you know, we would like to see people who know this and know what they want being members, the primary members of this council. In terms of the registration fee, we believe this fee is maybe a year or two too soon. You know, it's the actual next logical step if you're going to be doing something. I know Senator Saxhog had the fee pass permit, or the permit, I'm sorry, the trail permit, that's what I'm trying to say. And that, we're definitely too early for that, because we think that actually kind of chase people off the trails, because they'll say, well, if I need the special permit trail permit, they'll just stay off the trails and go somewhere else, and we don't want to do that. Eventually, we'll want to get there, but probably not for a while. So I guess as it relates to this additional funding, if you feel there needs to be more funds available for purposes, this is the next logical step. I can't argue with that. But we would argue maybe it's a year or two too early. And in terms of the dollar amount and all that, I didn't get the spreadsheet, so I haven't seen that. It looks to me like it's a little high, the estimates. So I'd like to work with DNR to make sure that we're, in fact, only spending money that we're actually going to be getting in. And then in terms of the enforcement, a concern that we've always had about enforcement, and I think some people have misinterpreted us in the past, we were told in the late 90s that we were actually not getting all the enforcement we were paying for. And we wanted enforcement, and we wanted strong enforcement. And we were actually subsidizing the enforcement division. So at that point, we said, well, we're going to argue against any more money for enforcement because we obviously aren't interested in subsidizing someone else. So what's happened then since that's turned around and we've gotten more officers, and by the way, we have thrown in additional money for the academies out of our accounts to support those academies, because we believe a key was to get more people on the ground, because just to add more money into enforcement without the actual bodies out there doesn't do any good, because then we were just, again, further subsidizing the enforcement program without getting it, the enforcement we're paying for. So we believe that's pretty much straightened out at this point, and I think for the first time in years, the DNR actually has its full complement of enforcement officers, which we applaud. So I guess my question, and this is a question I posed to Senator Chaudhry, is if we're going to be giving enforcement another $500,000, and by the way, our enforcement has gone up 600% since 2000 to 2006. If we're going to give another $500,000 to enforcement, we would like guarantees that that money is actually going to be spent on the ground enforcement and not siphoned off somewhere else. So that I think is something that, again, we're not opposed to strong enforcement. We actually encourage and demand strong enforcement. We want those officers out there. We want them writing tickets. We don't want them writing warning tickets. We want them writing tickets. Because that's the way you're going to change behavior, we believe. And in terms of the $500,000 for education, I know the DNR has $250,000 in their budget for the ambassador program or their safety and conservation program. So that leaves another $225,000 for other educational things, and we're not quite sure how that plays out. One of the concerns we have right now, and Senator, I haven't talked to you about this because it was an idea I actually just had overnight and was talking to some DNR officials this morning. Several years ago, we actually put money in the budget for trail specialists, and we had come under some criticism by the legislative auditor for our grant and aid trails that they weren't being built properly and weren't being overseen properly. So with this additional money that's going into the grant and aid trails, and we need that money for on-the-ground activities, you know, I guess I would like to see some of that, maybe that other additional $225,000 you have going into education, maybe be considered to be used for trail specialists. And again, we did that a few years ago, but because of the inventory process, we kind of lost those bodies, and they went to inventory. And I think that's something that I would like to have an opportunity to discuss with you in more detail about exactly how that money's going to be spent. Because if we add an additional $500,000 to grant and aids, then we really need to make sure that when we build these sustainable trails, that they're being done properly. And one of the things that I'd like to mention very quickly is this is a book that is just being published. We, meaning the motorized community, along with I think the actually contributed a lot of time and a lot of money to developing this book. And this is really kind of the state of the art for trail development. It's actually being sold not only nationally, but their request internationally. We were told the other night that someone from Russia had requested the book. So this was paid, again, primarily out of our accounts. And it's a really state of the art manual on how to build sustainable trails. And this not only applies to motorized recreation, it applies to all kinds of trails, whether it's a hiking trail, whether it's an asphalt trail or whatever. So, you know, we are committed, you know, I think this shows that, and this is something hopefully DNR will talk to you about a little later in the future. The state forest traditional areas, we too have an issue with this, with the counties losing their ability to manage their land. I think there is a way to do it, and it's the way it's been done for many years, and that is there's a cooperative effort, a partnership between the counties and the state when they deal with these forests or deal with other issues. That's being done right now. I mean, there are areas that are being closed off. For example, up in Paul Bunyan State Forest, they closed some areas up there where it was not appropriate to have ATVs in. And in fact, we worked for legislation last year to give the DNR that authority to do that. And there's a gully area up there, for example, where it has traditionally been a closed area to ATVs. And we ensured that, in fact, that happened. So I think maybe with a little more encouragement from the legislature, this can happen if you just encourage the DNR to make sure that that is taken into account. And it should be taken into account in the overall plan, because one of the things that you look at when you do these plans is the issue of reducing conflict. I mean, that's one of the issues that they have to look at. And obviously, if you mix some of the motorized recreation in the middle of where there's a traditional area where there's a lot of other activity, you know, that's gonna cause conflict, and we want to minimize that as much as possible. So I think a lot of that should be done, but in a cooperative effort with the counties working together with the DNR. And it's my understanding that's happening right now in northern Minnesota, and it's happening very effectively. One of the things that we're concerned about is that ATVs would not be allowed on forest roads. Does that mean that then cars, trucks, and SUVs aren't allowed on forest roads too? I mean, I don't quite understand why you can have a Buick, take a Buick or an SUV down a forest road, why you couldn't take an ATV down a forest road. And again, many of these issues, I mean, if you own some property up there and you're used to taking your ATV, going out your lane, going down a forest road to pick up your mail or something, you're not going to be able to do that anymore if you're in one of these traditional areas. So I think it's, again, you have to kind of think past the trail usage to other uses that we see with ATVs, and we're seeing it more and more as the price of gas goes up. People are using their ATVs to avoid, you know, driving their trucks, for example, on the forest road. This no trails of off-highway vehicles, I mean, that we understand. I mean, that we could understand in a quiet area. But the no hunting, trapping, using an OHV, I think that, Senator Parisu, I think that's an issue that needs to be discussed clearly more fully. Let's see here. I think we talked about the appropriation. Is there anything, Tom, anything else that you would...
I would just kind of like to wrap things up by, again, expressing gratitude to Senator Chaudhry and then to the committee in general on looking at this issue. And what I would see is with new open eyes and a new feeling of cooperation and being able to work together and taking some of the decisiveness out of this discussion. I'd also like to just kind of remind everybody of some of the history. The presentation that Forrest Bowe did on the chronology of the off-highway vehicle management program, it's kind of interesting. It starts with ATVs there in the late 70s. Being someone who's representing off-highway motorcycles, we have some events in the state forests that are going on their 50th year. This year will be like 50th years of some different events going on in the forest. So off-highway motorcycles have been around for a long time. Preceding ATVs by quite a while. I've seen some from like 1901 and such, so they've been around for a long time. And it was interesting to go through and see a number of these different programs that have happened and see that a lot of these things were actually brought forth by the user groups. That's one part that was not in the presentation was, you know, where did this legislation come from? It just says the legislature implemented such and such program and so on. Things like the OHV sound reduction for off-highway motorcycles that went through a few years ago, that was something as a user group we brought forth. That was a 50% reduction in sound levels by doing that reduction there. There's many things we've done. We've worked with the DNR for probably over 20 years now as a user group. We've been meeting with them on trying to get management programs, trying to create a system for riders to know where they can go. And I've always said by knowing where you can go, by default, it becomes obvious as to where you shouldn't go, you know. And that's one thing that I've always talked about is having a trail system out there in the state. And to me, a trail system is not defined as a map or a sign out on a particular trail or a particular forest. It's defined as an individual rider or non-riders being able to identify where they can go in the state to gain the experience that they are looking for, or understand that you are just not going to get this experience on state lands. Right now, that's something that is a little lacking. We've seen great steps and great progress towards this as the designation process has been taking place. But we all know that if we create a hiking trail that gets close enough to a waterfall that they can hear it, but they can't go see it, they're going to make a trail to go see it. You know, and it's the same type of thing with ATVs or motorcycles or anything else, is that we need to create an experience or identify the experience that is going to be expected there. If you're going to take young kids or beginning riders out for a first-time ride, you need to be able to identify before you get in the vehicle and drive for 4 hours that I should be heading south versus heading east to find that experience. because we all know that people sometimes will create an experience after driving 4 hours, whether it was if it's not there. So to me, a system encompasses identifying what opportunities are out there, both, again, from a non-motorized standpoint as well. We've been very supportive of quiet areas. We've been very supportive of designated routes. I will put a little asterisk or a caveat on that. We're very supportive of designated routes as long as there are designated routes. So what we're supportive of is the designation process being seen through to its fruition, getting those maps created, getting those signs put out there, and making the information available to the general public, both riding and non-riding public, as to where they can and cannot go. And then we are very supportive of staying on designated routes from the motorcycle community. We're also very supportive of education. I'm supportive of anything we can do to educate the population on what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. We've worked with the DNR. There was a mention of one of these pieces in here on a Responsible Rider OHV media campaign. One of the things that was done in that was working with some groups to identify behaviors of people. And this is actually just generic. It doesn't really have to be OHV stuff. But they kind of broke people into four different categories. There's those who just did not know the rules. Second category was those who could pretend they didn't know the rules because there were so many people who didn't know the rules. And as you went up the level, you got into basically violators or what they called rebels. And education takes care of the first groups, and the last group is what we have enforcement for. And there's many times we've met with the conservation officers and the DNR where they've told us about how they thought they were doing us a favor on giving this person a warning, not just a verbal warning, not even a written one and such. And we've told them to please stop that. Enforcement needs to take place, and without the enforcement, people don't really believe that there are rules. It allows people to be confused. Is it or is it not a rule? Is it a law? Can I or can I not go there? So we're very supportive of enforcement, but we're also concerned with making sure we get that enforcement on the ground. We don't want to keep paying for legislative paperwork, or one of the things that I run into when we're out riding is I can find the conservation officer in the trailhead. That's good. It lets the riders know that they're out there. But the problem is I don't see them outside of the trailheads and out on the trails. Now, I've had a few chances lately since we've had the dedicated OHV officers to run into them out in the forest, and that was very nice. But there's been more than once that I've come back by the trailhead and told the officers, you know, you really might want to head up to this section here because there's a wetland that I just had to holler at some people to get them out of there. You know, and then they'll pile in their truck and take off. But it's like if they had been out there, you would notice that people were heading that way, and you could see the tracks on the ground, and that's where somebody needs to be to stop that type of activity. The ambassador program, as I'm going to refer to it, is not something that is just out of Wisconsin, you guys. There are many, many states out there that have such programs. I think Colorado, Idaho, California. I mean, there's many programs out there. And the concept behind it is not about enforcement. It is not making these people into peace officers or any such thing. It is about educating the riders and the public on what is acceptable behavior and what is not acceptable behavior. Training of these people is very important. They need to understand a lot of social skills, how to approach somebody in a trailhead, or if you can actually get a person to stop, how can you approach them without it becoming confrontational, and just be striking up conversations with them and letting them know what the rules and such are. So I think a program like that is very important. It puts some ownership back on the riders as well and the general population on saying, hey, you're not doing me any favor by you traveling off trail or, you know, roosting through people's driveways and digging ruts or whatever it is. It's a social program to help people clean things up. So if anybody's got questions for me, I'd love to talk to people more about all the things that I feel we've done or brought forth. A lot of this legislation you've seen here in the past is stuff that I feel was brought forth by the rider communities. And I appreciate your time and effort and focus on this, and I appreciate the new feeling of being able to work together and compromise. It's refreshing.
Mr. Chairman, one other quick thing I forgot. Okay. I'd like to hand out to the committee the motor route designation. This is the 17 forests that Forest Bow talked about that are final. And I think if you look through this, you'll see that when we talk about traditional areas or quiet zones, there are six of these forests that have been closed altogether to us. So, and if you look at the mileage in terms of just the routes, we're losing about 60% of what's out there today. So our activity out there, when we get done, will be constricted. We're not expanding our activity. We're actually constricting it and bringing more discipline to it. So with that, I think you may want to factor that in as you look at this whole issue of traditional areas and even quiet zones.
I did have one question, actually, to Senator Chaudhry, and I don't know if this is something that you can answer, but I'm looking for what is the definition of traditional. I see that you have a definition in the bill as to a traditional area and the types of things that can be done there. But how long does something have to be in existence before it is considered, quote-unquote, traditional? Like I said, I can give examples of motorcycles that have been around since the 1900s. So
my bill makes the commissioner make that judgment.
Thank you.
Questions for our witnesses?
We should probably move on.
Yeah, we need to. Time is getting away from us. Thank you.
I think Audubon wants to talk.
I understand. We've got a witness from International Falls and one from the Clearwater area, and I may ask them to come to the table next, Senator Chaudhry, if you're okay with that. Mike Hansen, and I believe it's Mr. Cox. Bruce, is it Bruce? Welcome, and please identify. Oh, we've got three. Okay, please identify yourself.
My name is Mike Hansen. I'm a county commissioner in Cochise County. I'm also chairman of the Consolidated Conservation Joint Powers Natural Resource Board in northwestern Minnesota, and a member of the Minnesota Rural Counties Caucus, which is a 24-county organization. And very pleased to be here today. First of all, I'd like to thank you, all of you, for the public service that you give. And Senator Chaudhry, thank you so much for trying to step forward and to shed light on a very difficult, emotional subject. Today is the first day I've had the opportunity to hear any definitions of the word traditional. And I've learned a long time ago that I shouldn't speak for my colleagues, but I think up in the northwestern part of northern Minnesota, we don't want any part of traditional forest, none. And number one, on top of that, we have managed state tax forfeit land to the benefit of everybody in Minnesota at a very, very top 10 rate for many, many years, and that should never be in this bill here. Having said that, I also want to recognize that cooperation and compromise, that's all we've done for the last 15 years over this subject. And we're going to continue to do that. But we haven't even had the chance to sit down with the Department of Natural Resources to classify the forest in the county that I live in. I see parts of this bill that would create a hardship on northern counties in terms of decreased access, tourism. It represents increased economic pressures. And I know I've told you all before that during the last census, Cochise County lost 12% of our people. We're struggling. We can't take any more hits. We're not up there dirtying our sandbox. Stewardship of the lands is a number one thing that we keep in mind. We manage 275,000 acres just as a county. We gave a local school district $500,000 2 years ago. We're doing things in a sustainable fashion. The state forest block of ownerships, the county, federal, and state lands, I would agree with Senator Saxog, and I know that we would sit down and work with the Department of Natural Resources and the Minnesota Legislature to see if there is some indeed way that we could swap lands or create some kind of conservation zones so that there isn't this patchwork of ownership. I'm not going to extend a whole bunch of comment today simply because I just saw this bill, but I will again say that It is extremely slippery slope when you start talking about taking away county oversight on administered lands.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Well, let's get through the other two testifiers here. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Bruce Cox. I'm from Clearwater County. I'm the land commissioner there, the headwaters of the Mississippi River. I'm also speaking on behalf of the county land commissioners and AMC, the Association of Minnesota Counties. I've been usurped by a county commissioner, and I don't intend to talk in any way to get in your way, because I do work under the direction of the county board. We have an issue with the traditional forest portion of this bill. I think the timing is poor for it. We are busy working with the DNR currently as cooperators to designate two state forests that lie within Clearwater County, or portions of, and that process is going very well. And I would have to say it's going fairly quickly. The DNR reached out to the county board back in July asking for someone from the county to represent Clearwater County as a cooperator in the West Central OHV process. I was designated to do that. I've been working with the DNR in that process. One of the things about that process is even with a limited designation, which we're dealing with, either a limited or closed designation, the county board has already been laid upon in this situation. They understand that if they want to provide clarity to users in the state forest on tax forfeit lands, that they will have to comply with the designation within those state forest boundaries. So their hands have already been tied in some way in this matter. To take more away from them by taking those lands and those decisions away from them through this tax forfeit under the commissioner deal is a further frustration, because it's taking that away from them. I think, you know, right now we're dealing with the limited and closed. I think it's a good thing. It's moving forward, and maybe in a few years we need to look at this traditional issue, and part of the issue we're dealing with is non-motorized. We're looking at non-motorized areas in this process, so we're getting at that as well. I just want to reinforce it is checkerboard, and in a lot of these, like in Clearwater County, the state forest portions, a large portion of those are tax forfeited lands. There's very small portions of state forest or state land within some of those boundaries. So that's we got to deal with that. And then just to clarify, thank you, Mr. Knopf, that it is state land held in trust, or state deed land held in trust for the taxing district. So we appreciate that, and we've done everything we can to manage that. I guess what I'm trying to say is we just oppose that portion of the bill at this time.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Senators. I'm Norm Moody, the Cass County Land Commissioner. You've probably heard of Cass County. That I think most of this originated at Spider Lake a number of years ago, so I've been centered right in this controversy for many years now. I'm just going to go item by item. We're the county that had the first county to have a completed ATV designation process, and that was in the foothills. It is complete. We're in the process of going through designation on the Forest Service lands, which is the northern one-third of the county, and we're anxiously awaiting working with the DNR to designate the rest of the county. We want our county completely designated, and we hope to have that within 2 years, so people know exactly where they can ride, where they can't ride. All our lands will be classified. And I will come back to the mapping thing, because that's really a key issue. One of the things that I would caution people to be careful of is anecdotal evidence. And it was driving us nuts a few years ago. So what we did is we contacted the DNR and we said, we have some money. Do you have some money? Let's do the actual on-the-ground research. Let's put researchers out there 7 days a week and find out exactly what is, who's using the forest, when are they using it, how are they using it. And as far as I know, that's the only research survey that's been completed. So we know when they're using it, how they're using it, why they use it. We know exactly where they're from. We can tell you things you can forget about Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, because it all happens on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So think about that with some of your other issues. One of the things that staff is doing right now, because we do have some problem areas that we've been dealing with, is we're starting to quantify and qualify those, again, to avoid this the anecdotal statements of, boy, it's really being all torn up. No, exactly so many square feet, and we can qualify exactly what is happening to that land. So we're working on that, and we're doing this cooperatively with the DNR. Once again, cooperatively with the DNR. What I would hope you would do is let the classification process work. I mean, we'd love to be done in 2 years. We want to get our trail system in so people know where they can ride, and we'd like to identify areas that they're going to stay out of. The areas that you call the traditional use area, right now we have about 11% of our county-managed lands. And by the way, we are a much larger land administrator in Cass County than the state lands are. I heard somebody talk about seasonal closing. We already have that in place. Because we have the classifications done, we have trails that are locked up during the wet season. And it isn't a time of year. When those trails are wet and they need to be closed, you get out and you close them. And then somebody said, well, how about these special use needs? Because we do have beaver trappers, we have bait people, we do have a permitting system. Cooperatively, we put in place with the DNR. And for the first 24 hours, it was a dismal failure. Everybody was mad because the trappers and the bait people had to get this permit. Within 24 hours, we got the phone calls. This is the best thing we've ever seen. Please continue to do this, because the bait people and the trappers go in the morning when it's frozen. They have their permit. They can go around the fenced area and the gate area, and they're out of there before it warms up. And guess what? They don't have to fight ruts. And now they've said, please, keep this in place, and if possible, close more areas so they don't have to deal with the rutting situation. So it really does work. The beauty of it is once they have a permit, they don't have to come to our office again. All they have to do is call. It's all automated on the computer, ships them out a new permit. If they change areas, we just make adjustments to the areas. It's for designated and very specific geographic locations that they're permitted to go into. And I've heard about the ambassador program. We did something a little bit different, and it came out of that cooperative project with the survey program. We found out that when the surveyors were out there, a lot of the really undesirable activities disappeared, because there was a county truck sitting in different locations at different times of the day throughout the forest with somebody observing. So as a temporary thing, talking with one of our commissioners, I said, you know, this is really inexpensive. We already have the trucks. And for $10 an hour, I can put old Jim out there. He loves to do it. And by the way, he will not sit out there if there's nobody out there. If there's nobody in the forest, he goes home. He doesn't charge us. So that process was in place for 2 years. Jim has decided to retire for good now, but that's something that we're probably going to continue to do because it's very inexpensive. He doesn't need to be out there on Wednesday. He said, there's nobody out there. He says, I get bored. If I can't talk to somebody, or, you know, the people that want to come up and rip and tear the minute they see his truck, they're gone. He says, I'm either talking to people or I'm scaring people. And he's a very mild-mannered fellow, so he's quite interesting. One of the things I do hear a lot about, you know, we have to have the enforcement. Well, we've only seen one side of the pancake when we talk about Wisconsin. I've talked to the people in Wisconsin. There's a different system there. You get caught messing up over there, bring your ATV over here and load it up on the trailer, because the sheriff's department's going to haul it into town. That's a whole different system. If you say, well, we're going to have a $50 ticket or a $100 ticket, for the people that are out there doing the damage, they just figure into that into the cost of the weekend. It's not a big deal. But when you take that machine away, the game's over. So when we start talking about what's working and what's not working in another state, please don't cherry pick. Find out why does it work there. And if you're going to spend more money on enforcement and you don't have a punishment that is severe enough to curtail the activity, please don't waste your money on enforcement. That's all I have to say.
Questions for Mr. Hanson, Cox, or Moody? Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad to hear the testimony of all three of the witnesses, and I have some questions. First of all, I didn't ask Senator Chaudhry this, and I'd like to have his comments on it, too. But, Senator Chaudhry, you have, first of all, you're asking that you're putting in here that the DNR has to put a plan together that will get volunteers out to help monitoring and whatever they want to do on the trails. But then you have a prohibition in there against worker displacement. And I hear some things going on from the witnesses there that they're doing quite well in the counties they represent. So I would like to know what all of you may have thinking about that. I know that the volunteers have, in many clubs, have groomed the trails a lot on snowmobile trails, and I think that the some of the training that's going on in ATV use is probably making a dent in some of the damage. Certainly not 100% because a lot of people don't take the training, or they take it and kick it out after they take it. Would you have any opinions on that section?
I guess I have an opinion.
Two sections of the bill.
No. People who know me know I have opinions.
Mr. Moody.
Mr. Chairman and Senators, our chief financial officer, when I discussed this with him, he said, hire the people for insurance reasons. If you're familiar with the grant and aid program, we have some pretty stiff insurance requirements of these grant and aid clubs that operate on our snowmobile trail system. But for this type of thing, these are independent people. They work strictly for us. It's very cost effective. If there's funding available to the counties or to the state to put these type of people out there, they're observers. Jim was an observer. He observed the people in the wetland tearing it up. Took our cell phone. He made a call. It didn't take very long before the CO was right there, right at the spot. So for insurance reasons, for independence, that's the reason we went the route that we went.
And I'm sorry, I missed one point that I should have said in my question. Are you satisfied with the relationships that you have with the DNR, which I hear you sounding like you're pretty satisfied. I want to make sure I understand that.
I can tell you that the relationships that have been developed over the last 3-4 years are very satisfactory in that we've pulled the field resource managers who really know their areas, the conservation officers, and actually from our sheriff's department, we've got the trails and waterways staff working with us. So you have those three elements working together and coordinated. And as I told our field staff, pick out the 10 worst areas. Just do that. And actually, that took them some time. I said, we pick out the 10 worst areas. We map those. We GPS them. We provided the sheriff's department with the GPSs. We provided them with the ATVs. And by working closely with the COs, and we've just had, I can tell you in the last 12 months, it's been very acceptable. We're very pleased working with them.
Thank you. Any other opinions there?
Mr. Hansen.
May I, and I'll just be brief, Senator, thank you for the question. Cochise County is not as far down the line as these other two gentlemen, but what we would like to see is to continue to the Commissioner of Natural Resources method of holding out-state meetings to discuss these issues and problems and solutions, and through planning and upon review with those, seek a plan that works for everybody. Our relationship with the Department of Natural Resources has really never been better. And maybe it's further suggested that the authors of legislation that is restrictive attend these out-state meetings with us so they better understand the residents' needs and opinions that live right in within those areas.
Thank you again.
Thank you. Mr. Cox, did you want to comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just say that, the rest of this bill, other than the traditional forest areas, has merit. And we have a very good relationship with the DNR, and we depend on that in Clearwater County. We have no clubs to work with, and that's going to happen across a large part of northern Minnesota. Cass County has, there's some folks to work with. Crow Wing County has some folks, those push areas have that. So we depend very much on the DNR when we're looking at trail development, trail maintenance, those kind of things. A cooperative opportunity to work together to make that happen, because grant and aid isn't going to be an option for a while.
Thank you for that.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Chaudhry, you have others that are coming to the table, I see.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Mark Peterson. I'm the Executive Director of the State Office of the National Audubon Society. Minnesota Audubon has 13,000 members and 14 local chapters. And these members, this past November, has voted this issue of off-highway vehicles our number one issue that needs to be addressed. I'd like to thank Senator Chaudhry for his very thoughtful approach to this legislation and members of the committee. And
I just want to apologize for lack of attendance. We are getting cross-committeed here, and some people had to go catch up on some things, and I apologize.
I understand.
Welcome your testimony.
It's a busy day. Thank you very much for hearing me. Audubon's message in the last 6 years has been consistent and simple. Motorized recreation belongs on designated trails in Minnesota. The damage done to the wilderness character of our state forests by unmanaged off-highway vehicles has been well documented. OHVs have destroyed sensitive wetlands, riddled many state forests with user-created trails, caused erosion, diminished quiet and solitude, and disturbed and destroyed precious bird habitat. And I'd like to have us think for a minute about this idea of natural quiet. Really, solitude is a natural resource of the state, much like any other natural resource. And outside the boundary waters, Canoe Area Wilderness, this resource is quickly becoming more and more endangered. There's very few places now that you can go to where you can be assured of not hearing motorized sounds. And so this is a precious resource, and we'd really like to see this legislation address that resource and protect it. Habitat degradation from forest fragmentation also occurs when too many trails exist on an otherwise intact ecological system. The managed forest term is a misnomer. There isn't any sort of management occurring in a forest that opens all of its trails by default to motorized users. That's a completely unmanaged forest. Our specific concern is that many of the state's bird species of greatest conservation need, the term the DNR uses, are concentrated in the northern part of the state. These bird species have been identified by the DNR as being either rare, declining, or very vulnerable to extinction. The biggest threats to these species are habitat loss and habitat degradation. One of the most controversial and delicate state forests is in the industry's backyard, the Beltrami Island State Forest, our second largest state forest, which is 93% peatland. According to the Minnesota DNR, 65 of the state's 97 bird species of greatest conservation need are in or near the state forest, making it one of the highest concentrations in the state. Knowing this, I'm deeply surprised and disappointed that our state, either through the lack of DNR or legislative action, has not agreed to prioritize the protection of Minnesota's bird and other wildlife populations. Until the legislature agrees to reestablish a uniform trail policy of closed unless posted open on all forest trails, birds and other wildlife will lose habitat and populations will continue to decline. In closing, I'd like to briefly state our position on these policy issues. One, pickup trucks belong on roads or hardtack scramble areas, not on trails in state forests. Two, motorized rider education is a great idea as long as the state permits conservation groups bid for grants to plan, develop, and implement the curriculum, which we feel too often misses any messages on environmental education. And three, contiguous tracts of land on our state forests need to be conserved for the majority of the state forest users. 54% of Minnesotans are hikers. 10% are motorized users. Therefore, at least 50% of the state forest should be managed as non-motorized. As we've heard before, what happens oftentimes in outdoor recreation is that one type of use will displace users of another type. And this is what's happening with these motorized uses. There's, as I said, very few places where we can go and not hear the drone of motors. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if there are any questions, I'd be pleased to answer.
Senator Dibble, do you have a question?
Now, where is everyone? Well, Mr. Chair, I was interested in this 50% piece. I know that had come forward as an idea from the advocates, and I think is probably contained in another bill, which I haven't seen. You know, it makes sense. I mean, you know, sharing things, you know, equally, and it sounds like it even at 50%, it would, from the testimony, would be disproportionate in terms of the proportion of relative users of the same resource. So, you know, I have an amendment. I don't know if I'm ready to offer it. I don't have folks in the room to get a sense of where the committee is on the subject, but wondering if Senator Chaudhry could respond to you know, I know you mentioned it in your presentation of the bill, the 50% was there. You thought you might keep it out. What is your rationale for not designating a set hard percent of at least 50% for traditional areas?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, throughout this testimony that we've been hearing, I'm hoping the committee is picking up on the balance that my bill is trying to strike between all of these various opinions. There's opposition, as we heard, to traditional areas, so I put it in there without the 50% requirement. There's opposition to the ambassador program, but I put it in there with the requirement that all groups be included. Mm-hmm. So that's my rationale. Can't challenge your right to offer an amendment. I probably would oppose it at this time without further discussion and if there's other rationale. Again, those are kind of my feelings on it.
Right.
I understand where the Audubon Society is coming from, but I found that the discussion with the three previous county officials to be instructive, and I think I'm going to move to take out the part about the tax forfeited lands being managed by the commissioner. I'm going to move to amend that out. Not that I disagree with that, but I think because we've struck such a fine balance with the current inventory and designation process, I'm not willing to risk mucking that up at this point.
Are you making that motion?
No, I will do that at a later time.
Okay, so, I appreciate that.
Yeah, just real
Senator
quickly,
Dibble.
Mr. Chair, while I appreciate Senator Chaudhry and his openness to discussion, I'm not going to offer the amendment. I don't think it would prevail at this point, and don't want, of course, to create a hardened position by virtue of a vote on the record. But think that and it sounds like you're open to more conversations. This makes its way to Senator Anderson's committee. Additionally, I should probably mention, this issue of the ambassadors program was also brought to me just shortly before the committee, actually as the committee was starting. So I don't have my head fully around the disputes or the difference of opinion. But also welcome your openness to further discussion and refinement. It sounds like there's opportunity for discussion on both sides of that issue as well. So there is an effort to eliminate it and maybe distribute the money to other places. I won't offer that amendment, but I know that that's out there as well. Again, probably even more appropriate anyways for a conversation at the Finance Committee anyways.
I think MCA wanted to...
Yes, please identify yourself.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Chaudhry. My name is Matthew Norton. I do forestry and wildlife advocacy for Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I'm the staff forester and a staff attorney for MCEA. I'm a frequent user of public lands in Minnesota as a hunter, camper, a paddler, and mountain biker. I want to thank Senator Chaudhry for his effort to walk the fine line, maybe sometimes dotted line, between different interests, the very diverse and sometimes divergent interests that care about the use of state forest lands in Minnesota. I think that there are some excellent concepts in this bill, but some of the details, I think, would be very important in determining whether they work as intended or not. and whether they get full backing from a range of interests or not. The first item that I'd like to point out is the very big disparity so far in what the DNR has done in terms of forest reclassification and some of the surprises that the parties that participated in the 2003 legislative effort have received in that process so far. A great deal of discretion was given to the Department of Natural Resources in 2003, and we expected, frankly, a more equitable distribution of state lands across different management systems. Again, the managed classification, which is essentially the free-rein riding classification for state lands, so far has gotten the vast lion's share of state forest acres that have been reclassified. And of the forests that have been proposed for reclassification or that have actually been through the entire reclassification process, and there are 29 of those, 56% of the acres are in forests that are proposed to be managed, which is the forest classification that has led to the trail proliferation and the environmental damage and the social conflicts. 40% of the forests are forest acres are in the classification of limited, meaning that there are trails for folks to ride with the expectation then that they have to stay on those trails, which is a very reasonable thing in which MCEA supports. Just 4.2% of the acres so far have been in forests classified as closed. And if you refer to the DNR's sheet, which shows 17 forests, I'd just like to point out that the top four forests that the department is claiming credit for actually should not be included in the sort of tabulation of what's been done in the last 4 years. Why? Well, in the case of the Birch Lakes State Forest, that was already posted closed because of tremendous resource damage well before the ATV battles blew up, 4 or 5 years ago. Same thing with the Sand Dunes State Forest. That was already classified as closed. This most recent DNR process can't take credit for that. The Lake Isabella State Forest is on the edge of the boundary waters, in fact, partly inside the boundary waters. It was classified as closed in part. And the same thing with Insula Lake State Forest. And so what we have is the vast majority of state forest users in the state being of a non-motorized category. Non-motorized hunters are, for instance, are the majority of hunters. Hikers. The vast majority, according to the last 2000 data statewide, non-motorized use, recreational use in the state, across the state, was 72% of the recreational visitor days. 28% of the recreational visitor days were motorized uses. But we see the DNR's process resulting in only 4.2% of the acres being classified as closed to ATVs. In other words, reserved for people who want to have a traditional hunting or hiking experience. And so I think that the idea of having some range, at least acceptable range of state forests being in a traditional use classification is of value, because we have been let down by a very surprising imbalance in the DNR's discretionary decisions so far. Instead of, 72% of the areas being for non-motorized uses, or even half, we're getting 4.2% of the acres, which is just not what anybody expected in 2003. The first provision, main provision in Senate File 1538, which calls for off-highway vehicles to be restricted to mapped areas, by which I understand today means trails that have been inventoried and mapped by the DNR, I think is a good start. I do have some of the same concerns about the practicability, the administrative practicability of enforcing that, partly because it would be very difficult for riders on the ground, I think, to follow it when they want to follow it. Imagine for a moment driving from the Capitol here and trying to get to the War Road ice, hockey arena, and not having any road signs and just having a state road map and trying to figure out as you go by different turnoffs which turnoff is which. It would be a very difficult thing to accomplish. And the same thing is true with a state forest classification that was based on only on a map. I think that you do need trails to be signed open on the ground. We heard about the difficulty of posting all the trails that we want to have open. If that's the case, I think it's going to be even more difficult for the Department of Natural Resources to do the appropriate enforcement on those trails. Enforcement is going to take a great deal more effort. The same thing is true with monitoring. We have to be monitoring these trails periodically to find illegal cutoffs, to find erosion damage or sedimentation damage, to find new non-native invasive species outbreaks on the trail. And if we can't even get out to post a huge mass of trails open, I don't have a lot of faith that the trail system that's being envisioned is really within the bounds of the resources that we have to manage those trails once they're established. In terms of the ambassador program, and so just to put the last point on the map trail concept, I think that it's a very good concept, but I'm worried that it would be difficult to enforce, and I think that really the easiest thing to do is just to have designated trails that have been posted open the way the governor and the legislature voted to do back in 2003. The ambassador program, again, I think that the concept of it is a good one, and it's the kind of a concept that public policy thinkers and senators, I think, should like. The difficulty comes in really who gets to tap into that flow of money, and I think that's the source of greatest concern. The idea of motorized user groups who have membership that pay dues suddenly tapping into a couple $100,000 a year to run what's supposed to be a volunteer program makes a lot of people very concerned. Even if it's open to all groups, I think that, again, you hear some concern from the motorized side of things. Perhaps the best thing to do is to route the money through the Department of Natural Resources Office for Volunteer Services and Coordination and achieve the same result without the distrust. And just to give you an example of why, folks from the environmental and conservation sort of side of the table are uneasy about the ATV Association of Minnesota administering that money, we propose some things that, again, from what we've heard today, you'd expect reasonable riders to support. The idea of making ATVs more visible to conservation officers, having a driver's identification or license plate on the front of the vehicle, not just the back. And those very basic ideas were opposed by the ATV Association of Minnesota 2 years ago. They opposed forfeiture provisions that we heard were a good idea for ATVs when they break the law, and they opposed the concept of three strikes and you're out for violators.
Mr. Norton, are we nearing the end of your testimony? I'm just watching.
Yes,
I'm
yes,
watching
Senator.
The clock, and I know that we have at least one more. So,
yes, I've just one last point to make. On the appropriations provision, Section 6 of this bill, the addition, I think, of another $500,000 for enforcement is, again, a very good step. I think that if you ask most of the conservation officers, they spend a great deal of time. If you read Cuffs and Collars section of Outdoor News, you read an awful lot of entries about OHV enforcement. They spend a huge amount of time doing OHV enforcement, and the department and the Division of Enforcement need more money. $500,000 per year equates to, if it were turned into just dedicated officers, conservation officers, to do ATV enforcement, would be about 3.5 new conservation officers. It, in the first year of a new officer, costs the state about $130,000 to equip and to pay the salary and health care and insurance and everything else. So $500,000 is a lot of money. It's unfortunately probably not sufficient to provide the additional enforcement presence that we need out there. Why do I say that? Minnesota is very much under-enforced in terms of the natural resources laws by a couple of measures. First, the state now has about 5 million citizens. Back in 1945, we had the exact same number of conservation officers that we have now. The number of field officers has not noticeably increased since 1945, when the state's population was half the size it is now. So our officers have not, the numbers have not kept pace with the number of citizens that we have and that they have to have contacts with upon occasion. Second, their duties have changed and increased. While they have shed some duties, like running the check stations for big game registration, they have gained many more duties, including off-highway vehicle enforcement and personal watercraft and various other duties. They're stretched very thin. If we compare Minnesota's enforcement presence with Wisconsin's, they have the same number of field officers, and so it looks good at first. However, Wisconsin has a land area of 54,300 square miles. Minnesota has half again that much. We have 79,600 square miles in the state. And so each enforcement officer, on average, has a patrol area that is 50% larger than his field warden or her field warden complement in Wisconsin. So three new officers is very good, and that's a step in the right direction, but we do need a substantial, steady increase in enforcement presence, and it's not just for OHVs, but for all natural resource law and public safety considerations. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Dibble, or Senator Dibble, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Norton, just to play devil's advocate momentarily here, assuming that we're not going to solve that problem, we're not going to get a whole bunch of new COs, which is easy to imagine, and looking to the ambassador's program perhaps as a way to address that in the long or the short term, and recognizing that, you know, this is a forced marriage of sorts that Senator Chaudhry is arranging, maybe a shotgun, I don't know. you know, are there some things within the program itself, not in the array of global issues that were raised by yourself and Mr. Larimore, that might help make it more successful from your perspective?
The ambassador program?
Yeah, I mean, some of the certification stuff that's called for, the training, or maybe there's some more language that could be included that would mandate some monitoring and follow-up on the part of the department to make sure that people are doing what we expect them and desire them to do, making sure the money is well accounted for, those sorts of things. Just throwing it out.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, yes, conceivably. I mean, I think, again, what we don't – our concern is that a group with a very, you know, partisan, motorized perspective on public land uses, you know, not get $250,000 a year to run the program. We're concerned about that first. And so if it were run through the Department of Natural Resources volunteer office, that would be the first important step. The second step is, I think, to get a sense of where we can find volunteers. As you heard earlier from other testifiers, not all parts of the state have active clubs. And I'm not sure what the current figures are, but, you know, it's less than 5 or 6 or 7% of riders in the state are members of clubs. And so I think that if we're going to depend on volunteer efforts, it should be in a formal capacity. And currently, the bill that's proposed requires the commissioner of the department to enter into informal agreements with organizations that promote the safe and responsible operation of OHVs. I think that those should be formal arrangements, and there should be very specific groups, clusters of trails that are subject to formal arrangements. That way there's some accountability, so that if there are problems that are discovered that have not been addressed, then those problems can be followed back to a particular responsible party. And the last thing I'd say that might make this work well, and I'm presuming that Senator Chaudhry is anticipating the Department of Natural Resources will do exactly this kind of a thing, but to specify the kinds of activities that are included in monitoring. Monitoring can mean looking for erosion problems, but many times riders don't recognize an erosion problem as being of concern. We saw this a couple of years ago in some designated trails that were really destroyed because of riding at an inappropriate time, and riders kept going through the area. Are they going to be monitoring for invasive non-native species, which are a very important threat, a huge threat to the integrity of Minnesota's environment? If so, then they need to be trained in identifying non-native invasive species. And I think they need to have appropriate equipment, and there needs to be an expectation that they do it with a certain periodicity and that they submit reports. The Department of Natural Resources does have a monitoring program that they've been testing out for the past year, and it's not been perfectly consistent, and there are some problems in the reports that I've reviewed, but it's an interesting format. And they do have to give GPS coordinates for wetland damage, and they can submit electronic photos with their report. And those would be good things to include in the monitoring provision for this.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're so late. Mm-hmm. We got one more, and I'd like
all right.
one more.
Well,
I think
those are helpful suggestions.
Those are all really good suggestions.
Yeah, I don't
really
think
are.
That you do call for just simply sending $250 million over to, or $250,000 over to one.
No, those are really good suggestions.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Norton.
Thank you.
I just need a quick show of hands. Did I have another testifier sitting back here? Sir, did you wanted to?
This has
got to
be our last witness. I apologize. Got to be our last witness. We were supposed to leave here at 11:30.
Okay. Identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee. My name is John Kasson. I represent the Jack Pine Coalition. And I would like to speak specifically about Section 4, the traditional use areas. I live in a rural area. I operate a small farm, and I've been a professional forester and wildlife biologist for over 30 years. I spent most of my career with the U.S. Forest Service, and I have dealt with access issues in forest lands for all of my career. It's always been a very contentious issue, and in recent years, an increasingly polarized issue. I believe the concept of traditional use areas, as described in this bill, will go a long ways towards reducing the polarity we have with this issue. And I think it's a very progressive concept for Minnesota's forests. 20 years ago, dealing with access, we dealt primarily with managing forest roads, where we're going to build roads, how many roads are going to, and which roads are going to be open to public use and which ones wouldn't be. Anymore, we don't deal with roads anymore. We're dealing with off-road vehicles. Which don't need roads, has become a much more complex issue, as I'm sure most of you are aware. Minnesota is a very wealthy state. We have tremendous natural resources here. We've got more public land in Minnesota than most other states have. I believe a larger state forest system than any other state except Alaska, I believe. And I see a lot of citizens taking this for granted. I don't take it for granted. I think Minnesotans are very prosperous. But I believe that a lot of our forest management is almost based on a pioneer concept. Minnesota is not on the frontier anymore. We can no longer manage our public lands by default. We need to take specific actions to protect and manage the resources we have. And a big part of that is managing public access. I believe that the traditional use area goes a long ways towards properly managing public access. I've heard some people say that this this concept is extreme and somewhat radical. But I believe that if you were to consider 20 years ago subsidizing farmers to grow corn and other grains to produce automotive fuels, you probably would have thought that was fairly radical as well 20 years ago. I hope that that you will give serious consideration to traditional use areas, and I hope when you do that you're able to think about what our public lands are going to be like in 30 years. Think back what's happened in the last 10 years and try to visualize what it's going to be like in 30 years. It's an issue that takes a lot of a vision and, quite frankly, takes a lot of courage to deal with. These are not easy issues to deal with. I believe it's also an economic issue. I think Minnesota, like I said, has a great deal of wealth, primarily because of our natural resources. And the time is now to manage these for the future. We can either maintain our prosperity here in Minnesota, or we can become a poor, poverty-stricken land of abused resources. I hope that we are going to have the wisdom and the courage to take strong moves to look at the future of our public lands. A couple comments about things that were talked about earlier today. One about the original bill, I believe, talked about a certain percentage. There was just recent discussion about that here. I believe that it would be important to provide some guidance on the amount of land that would be in traditional use areas. I think the 50% number is a good swag. I don't know if that's anybody could tell you exactly what a good number is, a percentage of our lands. I can tell you that 20% would be probably seriously problematic, wouldn't be enough. I could tell you that 80% would be much more than would be necessary to meet the objectives of the concept. The other comment I would like to discuss briefly is the use of ATVs for hunting and trapping and other such uses. I understand the use of ATVs for big game hunting and for trapping. I've hunted all my life and I've trapped for most of my life. I've never used an ATV. I don't think ATVs need to be used for those uses everywhere. It is possible to retrieve a moose without using an ATV. It isn't very difficult. It's hard work, but it's not very difficult. And I think it'd be prudent to have areas where people can go and hunt or trap and not use ATVs. I think that desire is out there for folks. And quite frankly, from a resource standpoint, what's going to be important in the future as access continues to be easier for people is to have refuge areas, particularly for our wildlife, which where access is more difficult. And the only way to provide that is by restricting ATV use in certain areas. And that's really, to me, the concept, the most important part of the traditional areas concept. So I hope you consider that very seriously.
Thank you, Mr. Kasson. Are there questions? Before we move this bill, I'd just like to thank everyone for their patience today. And to those who didn't get to testify, this bill is meandering on, and get on the list and get a chance to be heard at its next stop. And Senator Chaudhry, what's your pleasure?
Mr. Chair, first of all, thank you to all the witnesses. I'm really pleased with the testimony. All points of view have been represented. It's been instructive. And I think I've become more, as this kind of, this bill has kind of been scrubbed over the last couple hours, I've been starting to feel really good about what we've drafted. I want to thank Senator Saxog for his partnership in crafting this bill and for co-authoring it. There are other authors that are gradually being added to this bill. I just think that I think we've got a really good start. I think all the details, I can't think of many details that were suggested here that I really disagree with, and so I'm going to seriously consider all of them as we move forward with this. We are going to have another crack at this bill in the Finance Committee, so the debate is not over yet. There are a couple of items I did want to move to amend real quick. This is on the Pariso question, page 3, line 30. After hunting, comma, I'd like to insert trapping, comma, and on page 3, line 34, delete that sentence, strike that sentence. That would be my one amendment.
We are adding trapping behind the word hunting on line 30 of page 3, and we are taking out line 34, just so the committee is aware. To the amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Carried.
I move that Senate File 1538 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? We'll move it on.
Timing-wise, we're going to hear all the other ATV bills. With regards to some of our deadline issues, not today, Senator Olson. I saw your eyes bug out. we're gonna put special emphasis on bills that have money in them over the next week or so, so that we can get them over to the Finance Committee for their deadline, and then we will make sure that we hear the other policy bills afterwards. So the agenda was probably a tad ambitious today. So, and we apologize for people who wanted to testify on those bills in particular, but I really want to thank the committee for its discussion.
Thank you. This committee is adjourned.
All right. Senator?